Hello and welcome to Dialect. Hello and welcome to Dialect for the week beginning Sunday, the 1st of July. Coming up in this show, we've got James Leeser, interviewed by Tony Gosling, on the decline of the British film industry. We also have Brian James from Soul Reads, which is a project coming out of Yajima Radio, which is a project encouraging literacy. We also have Nick Payne, a travelling man, author, and sometime actor, and he's going to be telling us a parable later in the show. We also have Tim Burrows, who's coming to play us some music, and Rosemary Dunn with some poetry. We've also got some swing jazz coming up, so stick around for that one. And we've also got Doc Satari, who's a Liverpudlian, who's been living in Bristol over the past few years, and also an excerpt in the South West generally, and he's going to sing us a song later on. We've also got the What's On Guide, courtesy of Jeff Sparks, and a little bit of Vivian Stanchel. I'm John Peters Coleman.
Well, exclusive writer and reader of A Nomadic Tale, Nick Payne. He's written some more stories for us, and these are in the vein of a parable. So here, once again, is Nick Payne. Hello.
Hello. In times gone by, there was a king who was out walking one hot summer's day. He had open-toed sandals, which was a little injudicious, as the ground underfoot was dry and rocky. Sure enough, he stubbed his toe on a stone, which made him really angry, partly through the pain it gave him, and partly through the humiliation he felt as his courtiers were witness to his misfortune. He hobbled back to the palace, aided by two courtiers, and immediately summoned the Lord Chancellor to his court. How can it be that we, the king of all we survey, can injure our foot whilst out innocently walking amongst our subjects? We wanted that you, Lord Chancellor, make it so that wherever we walk in our kingdom, there be carpet underfoot to cushion our feet. This task needs to be completed by noon tomorrow, or you, Lord Chancellor, shall be beheaded. Court dismissed. The Lord Chancellor was beside himself with anxiety, knowing that to carpet the whole kingdom by tomorrow noon was an impossible task. But he felt that if he at least did everything he could to complete it, the king would have mercy on him. He summoned mathematicians, interior designers, shepherds, weavers, indeed any specialist who might be able to help him in his task. He realised that he would have to pay them all handsomely, as they would have to work all through the night. But by tomorrow noon he would be bankrupt, but hopefully he would keep his head. Whilst the king slept peacefully, his wounded foot was well bandaged. The palace was abuzz with activity. Sheep were shorn, wool was washed, dyed, carded, spun, and woven into the most luxurious carpet ever seen. Planners and fitters began to cover the palace courtyard with this splendid cloth, as people ran back and forth in a frenzy to earn the considerable bonus that had been promised them. The Lord Chancellor had to oversee every facet of this operation to make sure everything went smoothly, solving mechanical problems, resolving personal ones. Murphy's Law prevailed everywhere. Every conceivable thing that could go wrong did go wrong, and come dawn, everyone involved was nearing the end of their tether. They were all exhausted, but remained focused, and with few exceptions stayed at their allotted task until it was completed, and then moved on to the next. The pace became ever more agitated as noon approached. The king was always punctual, and despite the hopes of the Lord Chancellor, had never been known to countermand one of his decisions. "Well, Lord Chancellor, have you made it so that wherever we walk in our kingdom there be carpet underfoot?" "My lord, many of us have toiled throughout the night and have managed to carpet no more than the courtyard to the palace. I beseech you to grant me mercy. It will take me months to carpet the whole kingdom."
"No mercy," said the enraged king. "Take him away and chop off his head."
Just before the guards came to take the poor chap away, a weaver, who along with the rest of the court had witnessed the exchange, inched his way through the throng, and with heart pumping wildly, bowed low to the king.
Your worship, I heard what you commanded, that wherever you walk in your kingdom there be carpet. Well, I made you a pair of slippers out of carpet, so if you wear these, wherever you walk, there will be carpet underfoot."
The king was overjoyed at the ingenuity of one of his subjects. He commuted the sentence of the Lord Chancellor to the banishment from the kingdom, and immediately appointed this humble weaver as a close adviser to the court. The Lord Chancellor was indeed bankrupt, but mighty grateful to be still alive. He left the kingdom and became a much respected and loved wise man, wandering through all the kingdoms in the empire, dispensing wisdom and healing to all for the price of a bowl of soup or a loaf of bread.
Nick Payne, thank you very much. One of the great tragedies of the post-Thatcher age, which reminds us of our present dumbed-down culture, is the demise of the British film industry. With the abolition of the Film Council by the LibCon coalition, the final nails are being banged into the coffin of a once-proud creative enterprise. For any film industry to thrive, promising scriptwriters need a chance to hone their craft, and they need good stories to work on. James Leeser was around during the heyday of British film, but he got into the industry through his first best-selling adventure novel. It was based on a true story of one of the only German prisoners to escape from Britain during the Second World War, Franz von Werra, the one that got away. James Leeser's latest character is Jason Love, and he explained how he works and showed Dalek's Tony Gosling where he works.
I've always loved adventure. I was not an only child. I had a sister who was qualified as a doctor and had a practice in Somerset in Stagumba between Taunton and Minehead, and she was 10 years older than me, so I was much on my own, and I would people this my walks when I was walking on my own around the woods and fields with all sorts of imaginary characters, giants and dragons and so on. And for my 10th birthday I was given a little dog, a mongrel called Mick. And we would have sort of adventures quite happily with these, at least I would, with the made-up characters. I've always enjoyed adventure. I intended to be a doctor too, but I was no good at exams. So instead, I was always keen on writing. And my father said, I'll get that out of your system. He was a schoolmaster, and I was apprenticed, or whatever you would call it, to the Kentish Times, the Sidcup and Kentish Times. Then I went in the army, and I was commissioned and was out in the Far East in Burma for about 3.5 years. And I wrote a book then, a novel in my spare time, page by page, and sent it back in air letters. And my mother got it typed, and it was published. And when I came out of the army, I went up to Oxford to, I thought I'd read English. And I wrote another book, and I wrote to about half a dozen newspapers, because paper, the physical paper, was rationed and you couldn't make a living starting off writing books because the publishers couldn't get paper to print them. And the Express answered my application favorably. I got a month's trial there and I stayed 7 years. And in that time, I was a foreign correspondent for them for a lot of the time, and I learned how to write quickly and against the clock, and how to tell a story, because the sub-editors would rip the thing apart and throw it away if it didn't go in with a bang. As Homer said, in media res, into the middle of things, like you have in a TV series, you have the hook in the beginning. The cowboys ride into the empty tombstone city. They fire guns, a house, a sheriff's office blows up, whatever. Then you get the credits. Then you decide, or you're told, what is happening, what you've got the reader or the viewer's interest. The one that got away was the story of the only German prisoner of war who escaped in the Second World War. He was a Hauptmann, Franz von Werra. Now, I met a publisher when I was on the Express, and we used to have a 5-shilling meal in Soho once a month, and this was the time of the escape stories, The Great Escape, Escape or Die, Paul Brickhill's Wooden Horse, and various other things. And he said, these are all British escapers, were there no Germans? And at my own expense, because publishers are notoriously reluctant to advance money for writers, I found the widow of Franz von Werra, and I also found she was a friendly with another Englishman who said he wanted to write a book. So we decided to collaborate, and this book was written on the kitchen table in the flat my wife and I had in Highgate, and we had one baby, one little boy, and it was written when I was on the Express too, written in the evenings and early mornings and so on, but it was a success. I mean, not the paperback in those days, the book club alone sold 400,000 copies. It was filmed. It still comes up on the box with Hardy Krueger, the German actor, playing the lead part. And I say I was the one that got away, because that made enough money for me to leave the Express and just write full time. Someone in any adventure story, if you analyze it, either knows too much about something, which he may have discovered or she may have discovered accidentally, or they know too little, and either way they're on the run, either to catch someone or to get away from the people who are after catching them. And it isn't crime, it's adventure. And I've always been attracted to buccaneers, and on the Express one met all sorts of astonishing people who'd done amazing things which one could never write about. People just wouldn't believe they were true. And larger-than-life characters have always interested me. I'm not interested in bank clerks and people of that kind. When we bought the house, this room had been two things. First, an apple store, and there was just an earth floor with bits of wood on it. And then I believe it had been used, either before or after that, as a schoolroom for the little girls who are in the house. And it's a quiet room, and I have an old dog. It belongs to my youngest son, Harry. And he sits in a chair, and I sit in another chair. And the secretary sits in a third chair, and I dictate. And it is then typed and retyped as we polish it and put in the word processor. And it's a sort of bolt hole, if you like. It's quite a pleasant, quiet room.
Tell me about Jason Love. Where is he as a character? Where is he coming from?
Well, Jason Love really is a bit of Walter Mitty writing. I wanted to qualify as a doctor, but after the war I'd spent so long in the army and I thought, well, really, I can't spend another 4 or 5 years studying. And as I read English at Oxford instead. And he is the life I'd rather, at least I tell myself I'd have liked. I'd probably been useless at it. And his house was first based on my sister's house down in Somerset, an old manor house where she and her husband practiced. And then I moved it into Wiltshire. And he is a bachelor, never grows old. You don't want old heroes, but under 40 always. And he has a cord and a housekeeper. And once he did an intelligence job, and as a result, his name is on the register. And sometimes he's asked to see if he could find someone when he's abroad at a medical conference or something else. Or because of his interest in the cord, he's asked to investigate not a political thing at all, but some economic matter where there's some skullduggery in a far country.
What are the qualities that he has that you most admire?
It's very difficult to say. The qualities, I think he's reasonably cheerful. I don't think probably I'm very cheerful. I'm friends say I'm a melancholic. But then if you're a melancholic, if anything nice happens, it's such a bonus. But he is a cheerful bloke. He has this car, he travels, and he is also never at a loss if he's being attacked by all sorts of people, which is a useful attribute, which I don't think I have myself.
Sounds like he's got initiative.
I hope so. People without initiative are just slugs, aren't they? They just crawl under flat stones. You don't want them. You must. I think people are like a battery. You either have a plus or a minus quality in your character, and I think the plus ones are much more interesting and more fun to be with, and minus ones are moaning they never had a chance or this and that and the other. I think old Love is a character of initiative. I hope so.
Author James Leeser there talking to Dalek's Tony Gosling 20 years ago down in the wilds of Wiltshire about his adventure novel character Jason Love. It's a pleasure to welcome Tim Burrow to the studio. Hello.
Hi.
So, how have you been doing lately in terms of your muse? What have you been writing stuff about?
Well, I've been down in Cornwall again in St Ives, and I've been down the Kettle in the Western Hotel. So I wrote a song for all my friends down there called The Kettle's Always Hot at the Western Hotel.
Okay.
And if you ever go down to St Ives, you want to play music, go into The Kettle. That's what's happening. And I'd like to dedicate it to my friends at the Mex as well.
Okay, take it away.
Thanks. Thank you.
That was Tim Burrows, and the name of that song was...
The Kettle's Always Hot at the Western Hotel.
Okay, and St. Ives is also the owner of a Tate Gallery, no less, which is also worth a visit as well.
It is, yeah, it's great.
Can people find you online?
Yes, I've got a poetry website, and I've got some stuff on, if you go onto YouTube and Facebook.
Okay, and put in Tim Burrows, and then they will find you. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Hello to Rosemary.
Hello there, John.
How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you.
Okay, and the poetic muse has been striking you in the past week?
Well, ish.
Right, okay. What would you have for us today?
Right, this poem is a bit of a challenge because the word that you're not supposed to be able to rhyme is orange.
Ah, okay.
So I've written a poem about orange called Who Says You Can't Rhyme Orange? Amongst the poetry community... It's universally acknowledged that the one word you can't rhyme is that of orange. Like any poet worth her salt, I like a challenge. That's the first word, did you notice, that rhymes with orange? There's twinge and there's impinge. Medics will recognise syringe. Sore-throated patients with a whinge are prescribed a lozenge. You can't fight this. You might think I'd take the pith. Get it? But if you have a door, then you're bound to have a hinge. And if you're a ginge, then you'll have an orange fringe. This is where I get heckled by someone speckled with freckles. There's herbal borange, which is a bit of a cheat. I'll try more rhymes for orange right up a poet's street. I've been finding and rhyming words with orange chiming. It would be far easier learning Mandarin Chinese for you. Yes, oranges are the stuff to stave off scurvy, mend neurons in a huff if you are nervy. If your iron's too hot and your shirt gets singed, don't consult a colour chart. The mark's called burnt orange. If you hail from Penge, you might say orange. If you're Spanish, it's arango, which nicely rhymes with tango. If you're a French girl pursued by Julian Assange, you might take to calling said fruit à l'orange. Essex girls out on a binge sport fake tans far oranger than a radioactive twinge. Each girl an exocet man forager. Who says you can't rhyme orange? Who says you can't rhyme orange? Don't be so regimented. Orange rhyming comes segmented. Whether full rhymes or part, embrace your marmalade heart. The campaign starts here, tangy, fruity as Zaire. Bucks Fizz could be your drink, packed with vitamin C and zinc. Whether Jaffa or Satsuma, squeezed from here to Montezuma. I even like the zest. Yes, oranges are the best.
Poetry purists and pedantics are all tearing their hair out furiously at this very moment. Rosemary,
no, never said anything about half rhymes or part rhymes.
Well, no, that's a fair question. A friend of mine and his other friend claimed to see a sunrise very early in the morning after they'd been up all night partying, which they described as exactly half blue and half orange, which they realised was not an identified colour, so they invented colour and called it blorange.
Ah, actually, that's the hair colour that we give to my daughter, who's blonde. And orange.
Ah.
Blorange.
Okay, interesting. Halfway. Are you performing out
I might have beaten him to it.
Maybe so, yeah. Are you performing out in public anywhere soon?
I am. I'm going to be performing that at the Hay on Wye Festival on Monday the 6th of June. 1:45. Be there or be Orange Square.
Thank you.
Time for a musical effort from a Bristolian producer and musician called F. Tup, and this is featuring the ATM Jazz Quartet, and this is like a jazz swing version of something that was originally a dance track, as opposed to what is usually the opposite. A lot of times you get dance music, which is based around a sample taken from jazz or swing. This is the reverse. This is a nice jazzy remix of Sweet Harmony. Thank you. Well, that was Effed Up with the ATM Jazz Quartet. He is a Bristol-based producer, a musician, stamp collector, train spotter and occasional stalker. And you can find out more about him on the internet.
It's my pleasure to introduce Brian James to the studio. Hello.
Hello.
You're involved in a project called Sound Reads.
That's right.
Okay, and that is connected with or is a part of Ujima Radio.
That's right.
For people who are perhaps not aware, what is Ujima Radio?
Ujima Radio is a Bristol community radio. It's one of, I think there are four altogether. It's one that's physically based in St Paul's, that end of the city. And this project is going to be about St Paul's and Easton, which is in the eastern part of Bristol, really. Mm-hmm. So that's what Ujima Radio is.
Okay, and how did Sound Reads come about?
This came about by accident, but basically myself and Paulette North are ex-teachers from the City Academy of Bristol, and she, by accident, got a show on Ujima Radio because of her connections and political activities. So she's a bit of a local celebrity.
Okay.
And so she actually got a two-hour programme on Ujima, and having got that, we then talked about the idea of having a project which was about literacy, because that was close to our heart, because we used to teach in that area.
Okay.
And this is a big issue, really, literacy.
Okay. Well, tell me about that. How is literacy? I mean, England is often famed as having rather poor literacy, considering our wealth as a nation.
Yeah.
Do you think that's got worse or improved over the past?
Well, I think it's improved, but it's still quite bad for people who are stuck in a position where they may have, in state school, got the basics of reading so they can read, but are unable or unwilling in themselves to read for pleasure or enjoyment because they can't actually read very well. And you'll be surprised how many people will say, well, I can read, but, you know, I don't read very often. Men usually say that.
Yeah.
Because they just don't pick up a book. And that means that the development of their reading has kind of stopped. And if you keep on reading, then your reading abilities will improve and increase, and then you'll enjoy reading more, and so the whole thing snowballs.
Okay. I'm always curious when people promote literacy as to which side of this fence they fall on, because some people will say they encourage a comic book reading, for example, as it is a form of reading, but others people say, well, no, but it's not proper reading. So
No, we're very much of the comic book variety.
Okay.
That anything that will enable people to enjoy reading is a good start. So it's a bit like, you know, if you had to go up a stairway, then if the stairway is covered in nails, then you wouldn't go. So you have a soft stairway and you'd go up the stairway. Well, with this, you can start anywhere you like, any kind of reading on the internet or anything you like, and that may push you on to read more in the future. But the key to our project is that the reading groups that we're hoping to start, or some already kind of exist now already, there'll be people who are established readers. There'll be people who read anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're hoping to do is to skill them up, to enable them to guide younger people to interrogate the text. That means to look at the thing that they've just read and find the meaning in it. Because very often people read and then they come back to me and say, well, I don't really understand what I read. I understood part of it, but I didn't really get it. So this business about interrogating the text sounds a bit like a dark room somewhere in Texas.
Yeah.
somebody with a cheroot in their mouth. But it's actually breaking the words down into their meaning and trying to get the meaning of them. And you can do that with another person. It's to go back on what you read. I'm a very slow reader myself, so I can read a novel, but I have to keep going over and over the ideas that have come into the novel, and I find myself going off at a tangent.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people do that. And that is interrogating the text, in fact, and that helps you to learn how to...
And how will this work through Ujima Radio in particular?
Well, interesting. It'll work through the reading groups. The reading groups will be set up, and they're mainly in established community areas and groups, but starting a reading group, and so we would do that in different areas. And then because they've got community links, obviously, to children, to younger people in their surroundings, then the idea is that it will pan out a bit and maybe pull in and hopefully pull in younger readers and get them to engage with the older readers so that there's a transfer of skills and enjoyment by reading the same text. A good example is one, we may be able to do this in local primary schools where we have parallel reading. So we might have a group of parents with a group of children reading the same kind of thing, maybe not the same text, but similar. And then they'll discuss what they've read. So the older people will discuss with the young people. So the idea is that you then blossom the ideas that come when you read, because when you do read, things come up in your head and you, there are things that you can imagine and other people don't. If you talk about it, then that broadens the experience.
Particularly, I guess, literacy is becoming more important because more and more of everyday life appears to involve the internet.
Absolutely.
Do you think that's a real divider, a lot more so in terms of literacy than a lot of...
Yeah, it's interesting,
the world
I think,
previously.
Because if you ask a lot of people, they'll say that the modern world is literacy's gone away, you know, that we don't read books anymore, but we don't have to read books, we read the internet. You can't really go on the internet without reading. You have to read, if you're on Facebook, you have to read what's written, and if you want to say something, you have to write it or type it. So in fact, I think we, as generally, as a population, increasingly are involved in reading and writing as a method of communication. So. Right. I think it's a growth area.
In this age of never-ending cuts, are you able to get any grants to help with your Sam Reeds project?
Well, we're hoping to... we're going to apply for a grant to the lottery through Grants for All. Mm-hmm. And we think, be able to get some funding through them. But generally, it's very, very difficult to get funding these days, as you say.
Yeah, I guess it's... It is difficult, and wish you the very best of luck with that. And what can people do if they want to find out more about Sam Reeds?
Well, you can get in touch with me through Ujima Radio, or you could look on Facebook, if you're on Facebook, for soundreeds at ujimaradio.com, and that will come up with the page that we've got for the project.
Okay. What other projects are you aware of, sort of around the southwest or nationwide? And, you know, what sort of research did you look into what provision there was for this sort of a thing?
There isn't very much, really. I mean, there are a lot of things happening, and there are a lot of reading groups. There's something like 2,500 nationally reading groups established. And there are a lot of reading groups in this area, in Bristol and around this area. But there are none in the area where we're looking, St Paul's and St Easton, which is why we're doing the project there, really.
Well, Brian James, thank you very much, and very good luck with your Sam Reeds project.
Thank you.
And a reminder once again, if people want to get involved with Sam Reeds, what can they do?
Just get in touch with the Ujima Radio and ask for me by name, or to get onto our Facebook page, which is Sound Reeds at Ujima Radio.
Okay, and if people have stumbled across us on the radio, how do you spell Ujima?
U-J-I-M-A.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
It's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Tory to the studio once again. Hello.
Hello.
So tell me a little bit about yourself briefly as a singer-songwriter. You don't have a Bristolian accent, I notice.
No, I'm from the Northwest. I was born in Liverpool and brought up between Wigan and St. Helens, and I've moved around a little bit. I've lived in York, I've lived in Exeter, and I've mashed it up a little.
Okay, so you've been playing the guitar for many years. What are some of your inspirations? Who do you listen to?
Inspirations to write this kind of stuff come chiefly from a fella called Tim Buckley. A lot of people have heard of Jeff, but Tim was his dad, and he died in the mid-70s. He was an incredibly impassioned singer-songwriter.
Okay, what are you going to play for us today?
This one is Spring on the Night.
Okay.
We got a thirst that could empty a river, long dark night to fill it with. We got a day to put to rest in the only way that we know how. Take it nice and slow. In a low dark bar while the band is playing, I found a new way to see the day. We got nothing to celebrate, but that won't stop us now from acting like we do. Lose yourself, raise your glass, so it's a breeze. Sink and tell come from me. Just let go, don't hang on, leave the world behind. Knock one back, feel the glow as another one flows right through you. And with a table full of empty glasses, find a new way to see the world. And let's put ourselves away in the only way that we know how, and bring on the night. Lose yourself, raise your glass, so it's a breeze to sink until another world in hazy company. Just let go, don't hang on, leave the world behind. Knock one back, feel the glow as another one flows right through you.
Well, that was Bring On The Night. What sort of stuff do you tend to write your lyrics about?
It depends. I mean, how I'm feeling when I sit down and write. I mean, that song I just played was simply about drowning the working week out with a few beers.
Well, sounds good to me.
Yeah, it sounds good to me too.
Can people look you up online anywhere?
On myspace.com/doxatory1. I've got half a dozen videos on there.
And do you ever play out live at all?
Yeah, I play at various places like Under the Stars.
Yeah.
Mr. Wolf saw those kind of places. The usual suspects in Bristol.
Keep your eyes and ears peeled, ladies and gentlemen. Doctor Story, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, 30 years ago, back in 1972, an album was released by the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, and the album was called Let's All Make Up and Be Friendly. It was their final album, at least until 2007 when they reunited, but it was their last album, with a certain man whose name was Vivian Stanshall. He has a local connection. Many of you will have been down to the Thekla, which is the boat where they put on gigs. It's a gig venue in town. And the reason that is in Bristol is because of Vivian Stanshall. Back in 1982, an idea bred by his partner, Kai Longfellow Stanshall, was to bring a boat down and to have a theatre on the boat, so it'd be a seagoing vessel where you could put music, bands, and they turned it into the Old Profanity Showboat. After a while, it got taken over by Massive Attack latterly, and they owned it, and it's now been taken over again, and for the past 6 years the people who've owned it have again turned it into a gigging venue. So that's the sort of the local connection, if you like. And what I wanted to play you was the track that was released 30 years ago this year, and on their last album, and this is called Rawlinson End, and this is based around the character of Henry Rawlinson that Vivian Stanshall created. He did latterly make a film about him as well, and that is available on DVD, and it's also worth a listen, and a couple of solo albums as well. And this is a track, I can't explain it, it sort of explains itself, but I'm sure many of you will be baffled, but I hope you enjoy it.
And pulled up roots and were arrested by the Parks Department. The mandrake screamed. Jeremy Sphincter has sailed for Australia after the poultry scare. We won't mention him again. Old Mr. Trelawney stays on at the farm, now a broken man and an incurable alcoholic. Apart from his regular visits to the village shop for a couple of tins of Ready Rubbed, he hardly goes out at all and devotes his remaining years to breeding those beautiful guppies for which he is so rightly famous. Sandra smells. Randy has turned in on himself. No mean feat for a 40-stone man. And after all, he is still married to Sharon and is only Paulette's father by the skin of his teeth. Poor Rosemary has her hands full at Warrenson End, trying to bring up Timothy and Letitia, now at that difficult age when they start asking questions and wanking. Meanwhile, Aubrey and Maureen Rawlinson have gone to the old house, convinced that there they will find something to prove Roger's birthright, but unaware that Paul Maynard is hiding in the priest hole. Now, read on. Somewhere inside my head, a bell sounded. The seconds jumped out of the ring and the minutes flew from the corners.
For God's sake!
Somebody shouted from the driveway.
Throw in the kitchen sink!
There was a terrific splash and the sink lay upturned on the floor, gasping like a landed fish. In moments, Aubrey was on his knees beside it, tenderly taking the limp tap in his hands, turning it slowly. A livid ivy of broken veins stretched autumnal on his cheeks, and the filth of the city found easy purchase in the open pores. Without taking his eyes off, he glanced up at Maureen.
Oh, darling,
he said thoughtfully.
You remember that party, don't you? The Bernard buffet table was over there, wasn't it? We seemed to drink oceans of bubbly and... Well, I did all sorts of silly things, and those rabbit costumes seemed... I jumped up on top of you. Well, everybody laughed at the time, but they never asked us back, did they?
I think that was the first time he ever kissed her. She turned from the window to stare at him.
He looks so sinister in that corset, and yet he can be so nice.
She noticed the bags and thin etched lines around his eyes, and the way his jowls hung down over his rumpled collar. He was breathing heavily from the effort of getting up, and stood there stuffing his stomach back into his belt. It was hard to believe he was still only 26. I could sense the tension in her body, in that old room. The air crackled with it in that old, old room, part panelled and part papered with a curious pre-war design of faces, and if you half-closed your eyes, they seemed to form roses of great vulgarity. That old room that had known so many joys, the laughter of children, and seen so many tragedies, and watched generations of Rawlinsons and Maynards pass on. The stuttering candle traced leering phantoms on the walls. It was almost as if old Sir Henry and that dreadful American woman were still there. She could see them now. Mrs. Radcliffe still at table, straight-backed and cadaverous, poised over her sherry like a mantis. And bucolic, jolly old Sir Henry toying with his brandy, legs well apart, coattails thrown up in front of the fire, expounding his interminable exploits before the blaze.
You see, natives had it in their noddles that if a chap's soul was pure, then the snake bite wouldn't harm him. Poor old Hargreaves died almost immediately. Horrible agony. I was going to tell you something about... the big fella. You see, Bunny and I went off into the bush after him. Did we find him? By God, we found him. I could see the rascal's eyes gleaming like coals. Then he was coming at me through the undergrowth, big as a tank, and a pair of tusks on him sharp as sickles. You've probably seen him up in the study, use them for defacing Reader's Digest these days. Well, rifle jammed, bloody useless. Bunny panicked, took off like a fox, little fool. Bearers scattered. Not that I blame him. What we'd seen back in the clearing was enough to turn any man's liver. Then he was on me, snapping and stabbing at my legs. I sidestepped neat as a blasted pansy and let go at the blighter with eyes clenched and fists blazing. Biff Wallop. I'm terribly sorry, darling. I seem to spill it all over my trousers. I think I'll be toddling off now.
They were walking towards a part of the hall I knew to be unsafe. It was no good. Whatever the cost, I had to warn them.
Watch out for that loose floorboard,
I shouted, then wished I hadn't. They both turned to glare at me. Then the rotten wood gave way, and frozen, they disappeared into the cellar. With an agility that surprised me, I sprang from my hiding place and peered into the hole. Maureen was head first in a barrel of dill pickles, struggling furiously. I knew she carried a snorkel in her handbag, but would she use it? Aubrey was unconscious. Sprawled in the smashed floorboards, he looked pathetic and ridiculous. His kilt had come off during the fall. With his eyes closed, he looked as he had at Ponte al Mare that summer. Older somehow, but that proud Rawlinson chin was unmistakable. And the cheekbones, a little higher than his mother's, they appeared as twin humps on the top of his head. The calendar pages peeled and blew away. The terrible memories started flooding back. Old Mrs. McAvoy eating that horrible chicken and the terrified child running from the burning factory. He was starting to wake up. I'd waited 4 years, flown 3,000 miles and crossed a seal with a Shetland pony just to get away from this man, and now
I remembered.
I remembered a tip of Dad's. The old boy had a thing about wasps and always wore bicycle clips while mowing the lawn. This seemed to keep a lot of them out, but would it be useful? Now for some answers. I hadn't planned it like this, but his eyelids flickered. A shudder corrugated his face and lost itself in the corners of his mouth. His lips turned up at the edges and waited patiently in the deepening shadows beneath the nose. Now, I was going to face the music.
Well, there you go. It's just our last show for a while. I played you Rawlinson End by the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, or pretty much Vivian Stanchel, all on his own there. Time for a What's On Guide. It's been written by Jeff Sparks. He cannot be here in body, but he is here in spirit. And to read the words, we have the voice of Ali O'Lighton to tell you what's on this week.
Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialet. Starting with Friday, 6th July, Cars on Fire were performing with support from Left Side Brain and also Emperor at the Croft in Strokes Croft, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. Also on 6th July, as part of the 2012 Froom Festival, Reef will be performing with support from Operation and also Emperor of Fools at the Cheese and Grain in Froom. Tickets are £23.50 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Alien Stash Tin. This group formed in Bartonnell, Bristol in 2002. In their career, have released one live album, one studio album and several singles and EPs. This is from the forthcoming studio album On a Pinstripe Planet, and it's the song Bomb 20. Alien Stash Tin with Bomb 20 from the forthcoming album on a Pinstrip Planet. For more information, you can check out www.myspace.com/AlienStashTin or one word, and also find them on Facebook. Into Saturday, 7th of July, Matilda will be performing with support from Atari Pilot and also Old Colours at the Victoria in Victoria Road, Swindon. Entry is £3 on the door and doors open at 8 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 8th of July, Never Forever, who are a tribute to Kate Bush, will be performing at the Victoria in Victoria Road, Swindon. Entry is £6 on the door and doors open at 8 p.m. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you, Eddie Lighton, and thanks also to Jeff Sparks. Well, that's all for this week's show. We've run out of time, so thank you very much to our contributors. Thank you to Jeff Sparks and Eddie Lighton for the Watson Guide, the writing and reading of. Thank you also to Nick Payne, Tim Burrows from Rosemary Dunn, Brian James, Dr. Tory for their contributions. Thank you also to Tony Gosling for the James Lisa interview, and also to Anthea Page as well, just for her long-standing contributions to the show. Thank you very much to Michael Noyce for engineering and producing this week's show, and I've been John Peters Coleman. It's our last show for a while, so thank you very much for listening. We're all going to take a breather now and recharge our batteries, and I'm sure something very similar to this we'll be back on the airwave soon. So take care and goodbye.